It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Summer-like weather lasted a long time this year, with September feeling like a summer month in the Midwest. Neighboring Minnesota recently logged its warmest September since they started keeping track in 1873.
And Wisconsin kicked off September with record heat days in communities around the state and logged a lot of 80-degree days in the remainder of the month.
What's been driving the hot fall weather, and what does it mean for Wisconsinites?
Chris is the Wisconsin State climatologist and a senior scientist for the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies Center for Climatic Research. He co-directs the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Steve, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Rob and Kate. Good to be with you.
Steve, across the Midwest here in Wisconsin, we had all these 80-degree days in September. It felt abnormal to me. Was my perception right? Was this a weird September?
It was a very weird September. In fact, the preliminary data indicate that this was probably the third warmest September on record in Wisconsin and among the 10 driest. And that data go back all the way to the 1890s.
And what is it that made this happen? How much do we point the finger at climate change? How much do we point the finger at El Nino? How much at statistical variation, I guess?
Well, usually these things are a combination of factors, and this is no exception. One long-term factor, of course, is the warming climate. So all of our seasons are getting warmer, and so a warm September in that sense is not unusual. But the magnitude of this was certainly unusual, and a lot of that was caused by a circulation pattern that was very favorable for warm, dry weather. We had an unusually persistent high pressure located in eastern Canada, and that was blocking the rain-bearing weather systems that normally move in here. And it was also drawing down dry air into Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, much like last summer's drought pattern, in fact.
Okay, that's the causes. You do a lot of work on consequences. People might look and say, oh, warmer September, great, more summertime weather, things like that. What are some of the consequences you worry about when we have all these abnormal warm days through the fall?
Well, one thing that's become a concern around Wisconsin is drought. It was not on our radar at all earlier in the summer when we were overly soggy. But since then, there's been a gradual drying trend, and it was really accentuated in September. And now in the northern half of the state, and the Northeast in particular, drought has really emerged. And in fact, severe drought has now been classified for Northeast Wisconsin. Some places up there haven't received any significant rainfall in over a month. I was just in Door County over the weekend, and I was alarmed by how dry it's become up there.
Okay, wet weather, then a big drought. But also, people might say, okay, well, we've got a longer growing season now in Wisconsin, right? If it's going to stay warm through September and into October, we're seeing even some 80s coming up later this week. But if I'm a farmer, for example, I don't know from year to year if that growing season is going to keep going, right? The unpredictability of it is a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so in many ways, this September has been favorable for farming. It's certainly been good for harvesting. It's been so dry. We haven't contended with early frosts, but this heightened risk of fire is very real. And that's a concern for farmers. And in the big picture, we're seeing more of this boom or bust precipitation cycle. Going back to last year, when we started with record wetness the first few months, and then we had a major drought. This year, we started with a drought, and then we became really wet, had some record flooding, and now we're back to drought again. So this is very hard for anyone to plan for, including farmers, and it appears that this is probably one symptom of climate change.
I don't want to beat precipitation to the ground here, but I feel like if I looked for 2024 total, Steve, it would look like a pretty average year of rainfall, but as you've been talking about, lots and lots of rain early in the growing season, basically drought in the second half. Why? What has driven, we've been talking about drove the heat, what do we know about why all the rain concentrated in that first half of the season?
Well, when we have these really extreme patterns, whether too wet or too dry, too warm or too cold, the culprit in the near term is usually a circulation pattern that's unusual. And this was not, this is no exception this year. So we had a very favorable flow pattern in the spring for rainfall. We were getting a lot of rainfall coming up off the Gulf of Mexico, plenty of moisture into the Great Lakes. And then suddenly we switched to this very different circulation pattern with high pressure to our northeast and bringing down this warm, dry air mass. So, you know, it's sort of a proximate cause. And then the long term, in terms of the warming trend, that's definitely climate change. So, for instance, we had a record warm winter last year. That's probably due to a combination of warming climate on one hand and also the very strong El Nino we had on the other, which typically produces mild winters in the upper Midwest.
We're talking to Steve Vavras, Wisconsin State climatologist, senior scientist for the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, Center for Climatic Research, co-director of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Winter coming here. Steve, you are part of the work you do is tracking our long-term snowfall trends here in Wisconsin. What kind of things are you tracking?
The snowfall record in Wisconsin is very interesting and somewhat puzzling. We have records going back to about the early 1890s. And if you just take the record at face value, you would think, wow, Wisconsin's really becoming a lot snowier than it used to be. On average, about a foot more snowfall in a season than we used to see. But there are reasons to question that, because the way snowfall is measured nowadays is different than in the past, and in such a way that it would tend to produce heavier amounts that are recorded compared with years ago. And so our state climatology office is trying to parse this out and really assess the record and figure out, are we really seeing an increase in snowfall, or is it just an artifact of how it's measured?
We'll leave it there now, Steve. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That's Steve Vavras, Wisconsin State climatologist, looking at a warmer than usual September, a very strange season as well for precipitation. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life.
It was 60 years ago today that the Beatles played their one and only show in Wisconsin. To mark the historic event, we're dipping into the archives and revisiting this story from writer Dean Robbins of Madison. As a Beatles nerd, it's one of my all-time favorites. Dean tells us about the madness that greeted John, Paul, George, and Ringo on their first American tour, and specifically their stop in Milwaukee on September 4th, 1964.
I'm one of those crazy Beatle fans who want to know every single thing about the band. Luckily, every single thing has been documented, and it seems like there's always more to learn. Lately, I've been obsessing on the Fab Four's appearance in Milwaukee on September 4th, 1964. It was their only trip to Wisconsin, and it was a memorable one. So memorable that people are blogging about it almost 50 years later. The madness started the minute the Beatles' plane landed in Mitchell Field. Hundreds of fans showed up to swoon at the sight of them.
I just like George. I like George.
But the 80 police officers on hand wanted nothing of the sort, so they arranged for the plane to land far away from the crowd.
They are on their way to their hotel at this time.
Then they shuttled the Beatles through a back exit where no one could see them. The band complained to no avail. Later, at a press conference, Paul McCartney accused the police of pulling a dirty trick.
We have been told that the decision to land was made by your manager in the air.
There was no need to take us out the back way. Just at least drive past the fans, you know, in a car. And again, they told us no. And he's a dirty, lying policeman who told you that.
The Beatles didn't treat the local press any more respectfully than they did the local police. A reporter asked them what they planned to do when their bubble burst. Guitarist George Harrison answered.
Call your coffee.
Tickets for the show at Milwaukee Arena topped out at $5.50. Red Cross workers, armed with ammonia inhalants, stationed themselves around the arena to treat fainting girls. As for the performance, it was drowned out by the screaming of 12,000 fans. The screams were so relentless that no one could tell All My Loving from Can't Buy Me Love. Nevertheless, the Beatles rocked, and they playfully engaged the crowd between songs. Everybody there remembers having a good time. Before the band left town, McCartney took a minute to call a local fan in the hospital. He had heard she didn't get a chance to see the show. The band may have had no use for Wisconsin's disapproving elders, but they loved the kids who responded so passionately to their music. I should tell you why I've been obsessing on the Beatles' visit to Milwaukee. It's because I got to see a Beatle there myself this past July. Paul McCartney performed at a sold-out Miller Park, with ticket prices well over $5.50. In many ways, though, the performance made me think of 1964. Paul still playfully engaged the crowd. And at age 71, he still rocked with a vengeance. When he launched into All My Loving, a number he'd also sung with the Beatles in Milwaukee, I couldn't help myself. I screamed.
That archival Wisconsin life story was brought to us by Dean Robbins of Madison. He wrote about the Beatles' one and only show in Wisconsin, which was 60 years ago today. Thanks to TMJ4 for the archival audio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell & Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out why affordable childcare is hard to find and meet a Manitowoc business owner who tried to tackle the problem.
I felt like we needed to do something to help them because these are the kids in our community, but even closer, they're the kids of our employees.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last month on the show, we talked about the results of a recent report from UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty, where researchers studied childcare supply and demand challenges facing Wisconsin.
The study found that more than half of Wisconsin's childcare providers are operating below capacity. That's mostly due to understaffing and providers' inability to afford to pay their workers competitive wages.
At the same time, childcare around the state continues to get more expensive for families.
In Manitowoc, one CEO saw the challenges his employees were facing trying to find affordable care and decided he wanted to do something about it. We'll talk with him about the steps he's taken to make childcare more accessible for his employees.
But first, we'll get a better picture of the childcare landscape in Wisconsin with Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Ruth, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this will come as no surprise to many people in Wisconsin. There's kind of a childcare crunch facing people. Give us a rundown of the current state of childcare in Wisconsin, please, Ruth.
So what we know about the current state of childcare is that based on a report that came out just 2 weeks ago from the Institute for Research on Poverty, we have looked at childcare and we know that there are right now 33,000 slots of childcare that are in classrooms that are empty because we do not have childcare staff for those positions. So we have a shortage of somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 child care providers in our state. And we also know that the trends that we see due to the lack of available care in communities is that we see our the level of women in our workforce declining. We have hit the lowest rate of women in our workforce since the 1980s at just 59%. We know that the cost of childcare is continuing to go up. We have looked at recent data that says that just over the past 12 months, we've seen the cost of childcare go up on average 14% in Wisconsin. We also know that that correlates to what we call a decline in the Child Care Counts program. The Child Care Counts program is a mechanism by which federal dollars came into the state. The state was able to pump those out literally into child care programs directly to help cover operating costs, to help pay their staff, to provide bonuses. And as that money declines over time, and it'll be fully eliminated by July of 2025, we anticipate we'll see another dramatic increase in the cost of childcare. So we know we have a shortage of childcare because we cannot staff those positions in our state due to poor revenue streams into childcare that limits what they can pay to their teachers. Teachers are getting paid approximately $13 an hour, which is less than 50% of what the average individual working in Wisconsin makes. And so this all results in, I think, just a real struggle for families in terms of affordability, struggle of childcare programs to keep their doors open over time. And it is, it's concerning as we see the trends in a lack of childcare and the increase in prices continue over time.
And Ruth, we talk a lot about the market and some of the things shaping this. I know an important point for you is, what does this all mean for the kids themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern we have in terms of what's happening with children is that ensuring that especially children who are living in income-constrained households that ultimately often have the highest need for childcare, that those children only have access to about half of the childcare market in our state. And so a lot of families simply cannot find care for children. And in those situations, we worry significantly about the health and safety of those children in terms of where are those children when their parents have to be at work. We know that there is unregulated opportunities for care through a relative, a friend. But we also know that the care that children can get in high quality early childhood programs, you can't put a dollar value on that. It prepares them for lifelong learning. It meets their social emotional needs. And we're very concerned about what's happening if we know we've got 33,000 slots of care that we cannot fill with kids because we don't have teachers. We are very concerned about what's happening to those children.
Some people in the business world are trying to get creative and find solutions here. In just a few moments, we'll hear from a business leader who's subsidizing childcare for employees. I know you don't see that as the complete solution. Do you see positive signs, though, that that can help make a difference?
I absolutely think that employers have a role to play in looking at possible options for solutions in terms of what's going on in childcare. Where I land on that issue is there's a lot that employers can do that will be supporting their employees. That's the appropriate place for them. They support their employees. But the unfortunate downside of that is it doesn't result in new increased revenue streams coming into the childcare workforce itself. And so until we find those revenue streams, which I believe comes from a government investment into childcare, which is what a lot of states are figuring out right now, we need to really focus on ways that employers can also lend their voices when it comes to sort of advocating for a public investment into childcare. because quite honestly, without it, we cannot just rely on parents and employers to be able to afford covering the true cost of what care and what early childhood educators need in order to have a living wage as they're doing this important work.
And that takes us back to the Child Care Counts funding that you mentioned from the federal government during COVID. That federal money, of course, has been going away. Do you see prospects to get it replaced here in Wisconsin?
What I can tell you is we are working around the clock on that issue. We engage with individuals from multiple sectors in the state of Wisconsin through a coalition called Raising Wisconsin to work on ensuring that we're all putting the same ask forward in terms of ongoing state investment of significant state revenue into childcare. If you want to call it Child Care Counts, that's the governor's program. That is something that I believe firmly in. But the bottom line is we need a bold state investment in child care so that what employers are doing and what parents can do can actually turn the dial on what's happening in this field right now.
As we wrap up, Ruth, what do you see as the consequences if we don't backfill that federal funding?
Yeah, I think those consequences are really kind of scary. We will continue to see programs closing. We know that since 2013, we've seen 26% of childcare programs close in our state. We will continue to see that trend. We will continue to see the cost of care going up significantly by double digits and families unable to purchase that care. And we will see, most importantly, our children not having access to the best possible starts in life.
Ruth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Ruth Schmidt is the executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Now the CEO of one Wisconsin company has made an effort to help his employees and their families get access to childcare. Sachin Shivaram is CEO of Wisconsin Aluminum Foundry in Manitowoc and chair of the Governor's Council on Workforce Investment. Sachin, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
What right now is your company offering in terms of childcare assistance for your employees?
We offer all of our employees $400 a month to reimburse them for any childcare expenses that they have.
And are there strings attached? Has to be a particular kind of childcare or anything like that?
You know, we started that way. When we first started on our childcare journey, we wanted to encourage our employees to migrate to kind of higher quality care. And so we said that you'll get $400 if you're going to a licensed childcare provider. And, to nobody's surprise, of course, we found that our employees couldn't find spots in licensed care facilities. And so we just expanded it to any sort of care expense that they have. And so no strings attached, no requirements. And frankly, we're pretty loose on the documentation that they need as well. I mean, we have people whose grandmother or neighbor cares for their child, and they just send us an email saying, yes, I care for this child. And that's all we require.
Sachin, let's go back to the beginning of that child care journey. So you're in the aluminum business. What got you interested in the child care needs of your employees?
Yeah, I was having just chatting with an employee before he started his shift. We were in the parking lot and we were just chit-chatting and I peeked into the back of his car and he had this pink car seat in there. And, I'll never forget, it was just in a sea of garbage, Mountain Dew bottles and chip wrappers. And I just kind of had a pang of worry. I said, oh, I see you have a child. And then he said, yeah, I'm a single dad actually. And, the car seat was pink, so I could tell it was a girl. And he said that she was 4 years old. And I asked him what he did for childcare. And he said that, I take her to a different home each day. Sometimes it's a neighbor and I have relatives in the area. And it really kind of got me like a little choked up. And even now as I think about it, I was just imagining this little girl, backpack and blanket in tow, toothbrush and going from house to house. I felt sad. I felt disappointed in ourselves that our employees are, not able to afford the best for their children. I felt like we needed to do something to help them because these are, you know, the kids in our community, but even closer, they're the kids of our employees.
The monetary assistance you were just talking about, that wasn't plan A. You kind of went big at first and thought, okay, as I understand it, what did you do?
We started from scratch. I mean, we thought we were just going to revolutionize childcare. I mean, we're pretty good at making aluminum castings, and we thought, okay, we'll just bring the same brain to childcare. And, you know, I sat down with a few people in the community whom I trust, you know, the CEO of the local YMCA and some other childcare providers. And I said, you know, let's bring a great childcare solution to the Manitowoc community. You know, what will that take? And we want to pay everybody a living wage. At the time, we were paying $20 an hour. Today, we pay an average of about $26 an hour. And so at the time, we said, okay, well, we pay $20 an hour at our business. That's what we're going to pay to these teachers. And what else do we need? How much space do we need? You know, how much, you know, what do we need in terms of technology? And I had these visions of, you know, creating the type of excellent childcare center. You know, my wife and I have friends from college and law school who live in Houston and Washington, D.C. and Chicago and big cities, and they have access to this tremendous, you know, childcare, you know, industry. And I was like, we're going to bring something like that to Manitowoc. And, you know, I'll never forget, we built a little model in Excel and, you know, tabulating all the costs. And then we said, okay, how many kids are we going to have? And then you divide the cost by the number of kids. And it came out to, I think, somewhere around $42,000 per year per child, which is crazy. You know, and actually, some people do pay that. You know, I bet, you know, this high quality childcare that exists in some places, that's what it costs at least. But we realized, you know, that's not going to work. You know, nobody can really, in our community, can really afford to pay that amount of money. And then we went through all sorts of different solutions, potential solutions. We tried to create a consortium of local businesses to fund a new childcare center. We applied twice for the Workforce Innovation Grant that the WDC in Wisconsin put on during the COVID time using ARPA funds. And, you know, we also worked on an initiative with the local Chamber of Commerce, but just nothing was working. You know, we were aiming for a structural change and we just couldn't get there. And, you know, along the way, as we realized these solutions weren't materializing, we felt we needed to do something for our employees, which we thought was going to be a stopgap. But it is now the solution that we've continued with, which is that $400 a month policy.
I got to say, as, you know, a business guy looking at getting into childcare like this, what does that make you think about, you know, the entrepreneurs, the people who are actually doing childcare right now? The way you just laid it out, it sounds almost impossible.
Oh, yeah, it is impossible. And, you know, I've visited many childcare centers now, you know, during the course of our journey. And it's clear to me that it would not be possible if the people who work in these places were not, you know, I almost want to use religious terminology, like if they weren't just answering some higher calling. You know, I mean, they are really giving of themselves and taking a very low wage to be able to do that work, probably because they care for kids, they care for the community, they enjoy it. Also, they, you know, many of them get the benefit of having free childcare for their own, you know, children at centers, which is worth something, you know. But I just came away with a profound respect and really sincere appreciation for the people that give of themselves to staff this industry that is, you know, economically, it doesn't make sense. Like Ruth mentioned that they make $13 an hour. I mean, we pay, as I mentioned, $26 an hour, and we can't find enough people. You know, how you find people who are able to work for $13, you know, boggles my mind, unless you understand that they're doing it for non-monetary reasons.
Yeah, Ruth Schmidt, who we just heard from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, made the case that we can't really square this circle without, as she argued, some kind of government funding. Is that the page you are on now, or do you think there are other solutions out there?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, this is a public good, you know, just like public education. This is just an extension of that, and. You know, even more critically important, I'd argue, the years of 0 to 5. And we know that, you know, the economy, the private sector, whether it's through, you know, parental contributions or through companies, simply cannot sustain that level of spending. You know, I mean, even if you cut the $40,000 in half and say it's on average $20,000, Yeah, that's just a non-tenable expense for most people. In our company, we pay the $400 a month extra. That's about $5,000 per employee, which, you know, compared to the wage they make, it's about $50,000. This is a 10% increase in wages. I mean, that's not sustainable either for most companies, or even for us, frankly. And so, you know, and that's not, that doesn't even get us the whole way to make up the gap. It gets us a quarter of the way to make up the gap. And so, there's a big gap that's worth, you know, public money to invest in. And I absolutely believe that, you know, public solution has to be a big part of this.
In the meantime, Sachin, bringing things back around to that single dad you mentioned, the other employees using this, as you mentioned, this isn't a magic solution for everybody, but do you get the sense that helping subsidize their childcare is at least making some difference for your employees with kids?
Yes. I mean, without a doubt, you know, our motive in this clearly is about workforce, you know, to help make our work sustainable for our employees, but is even more fundamentally, you know, you asked Ruth, when you were talking with her about what does this mean for the kids? And this is about, you know, the child's experience and helping them, access a trajectory for their lives by learning to read when they're young and having a nurturing environment. That's what motivates us. And, I got to believe that child experience is the motivation for all of us who are working on behalf of this problem.
Sachin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Sachin Shivaram is the CEO of Wisconsin Aluminum Foundry in Manitowoc and chair of the Governor's Council on Workforce Investment. We also heard from Ruth Schmidt, executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association.
Coming up, meet a Wisconsin author who set her novel for young people here in the state.
I never was able to open up a book and see Wisconsin reflected in the pages, to be able to look and say, I live there. And I wanted to give that gift to kids in Wisconsin.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Even casual fans of a particular British baking competition show know the power that preparing food can have to bring people together.
The sensory experience of baking can transport us through the feel of working with the ingredients and the smells wafting from the oven.
Baking may remind us of loved ones who've passed and the recipes they were known for. Those are some of the themes behind the new novel by Wisconsin author Laura Ann Bird.
Laura is on the board of the Madison Public Library Foundation. She's also an ambassador for the Wisconsin Book Festival and co-founder of the Great Midwest Book Group. Her new middle school grade novel is called Marvelous Jackson. Laura, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
You bring out this strong hunting tradition in the life of a close-knit community in the North Woods. Why did you decide to set the story in northern Wisconsin?
Well, I am born and raised in Wisconsin, and I was a voracious reader growing up. And I think with the exception of The Little House on the Prairie books by Laura Ingalls Wilder, I never was able to open up a book and see Wisconsin reflected in the pages, to be able to look and say, I live there. And I wanted to give that gift to kids in Wisconsin. I think Wisconsin has such an amazing tradition. We have a beautiful landscape. We have the hunting, the fishing, culinary traditions, and really great people that live here. And I want kids to be able to see that reflected in the pages.
I appreciate how your seventh grader just bikes everywhere and really has the freedom to go between this lake community and get to the places he goes, whether it's in cold winter or in other months. Can you talk about the setting a little bit and what you're trying to bring out?
Sure. So the setting is a fictional town called Allwyn, Wisconsin, which is based on any number of northern towns that we all have been to, Minocqua, Rhinelander, Eagle River, Boulder Junction. There is such spirit up north, and it's my favorite place on earth. And I really wanted to capture that spirit in the pages. And just like you said, Jack's bike is his vehicle to independence. He has just lost his mom, and his dad is always at work at his tavern in the Northwoods, feeding all the hungry hunters. And so without that bicycle, Jack really has no way to get from one part of Alwyn to the next.
And, you know, Jack points out pretty early on, girls, can hunt, guys can bake. You're really trying to break down some stereotypes in the pages. Can you talk about that effort and how Jack sees it?
Sure. Well, Jack embarks on the search for a hobby in order to get himself out of trouble because he's gotten himself into a few scraps here and there at school and at home. And so he knows that a hobby is his way to get on the right path and stay out of trouble. But what hobby to give him? So I sort of went through all these different options as I was writing the book. You know, is it skateboarding? Is it chess? And I landed on baking. Because I love that it uses both sides of the brain. He's able to be creative and artistic, and he's also able to use that mathematical side, which I think is so important. And the fact that he is also a boy falling in love with being in the kitchen really, I think, is an added benefit. I want him to show kids that you can do anything. I mean, in my first book, Crossing the Pressure Line, the main character is a 12-year-old girl who loves to musky fish. So why not? Shake things up.
It's interesting, the tension there, because his dad runs this tavern, not a baker, and really wants his son to be part of that tavern community, to work in the kitchen, to make the recipes. But that's really not Jack's calling. And he's able to flip through his mother's, baking cookbooks and really get pieces of her. Can you talk about the tensions there between father and son?
Well, what's funny is they're both such stubborn characters. Norm is the father, you know, Jack is the 13-year-old. And Jack spends so much of the story telling himself that he's so different than his dad. And all his dad wants to do is be in that kitchen at Dutch's A1 Tavern. And that's not of interest to Jack, but, you know, baking is. But it's so funny because baking and cooking are like two sides of the same coin. And I think ultimately Jack comes to find out that he and his dad are so much alike in the end.
Why have you chosen to write for a middle grade audience?
Middle grade is my sweet spot. I love middle grade. So if you think back to when you were 8 to 12 years old, and you walked in the library, and it was like the first time that you could go in the stacks and pick out exactly what you wanted to read. Those books that lit a fire under you for literature and for storytelling, I can almost guarantee they were middle grade novels. A Wrinkle in Time, yeah. Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, mm-hmm. Where the Red Fern Grows. These are all like middle grade staples. And I love writing for that audience. Because so much growth and development is happening during that time. And there are so many competing values that kids are faced with. Like, I think a lot of kids that age are striving for independence. You know, they want to do their own thing, but they still want their parents to tuck them in at night before bed. They want to stand out from the crowd, but they still want to fit in and have friends. And those competing values can collide like angry little atoms in real life, as we know, because we've raised yes. the children. But they sure make for fantastic fiction. And I'm delighted to reach into that age group and to meet them where they're at and to show them that they're not alone and that they're seen and heard and validated.
One of my favorite moments is Norm and Jack each are like preparing for this nuggy first ever chicken nugget competition, and they go on this secret late night rival restaurant, you know, mission to figure out what is in the nuggy recipe. Can you talk about that moment in their relationship and really what's going on there?
Well, I love that you brought up the nuggy competition. The nuggies are such a big part of the book because You know, Norm is entering his restaurant into the first ever Northwoods Nuggie competition, and he is so dead set on winning this thing. At the same time, Jack himself is trying to secure an audition for the Marvelous Midwest Kids Baking Championship television show in Chicago. So you can see they are both on, like, parallel tracks here. They're both trying to accomplish these big things. And I think that whole Nuggie Intel mission of which you speak is really important for Jack, because in middle grade fiction, it's the kids, it's those main characters that need to move the plot forward. They're the ones that are the agents for change, if you will, because no middle grade kid wants to read a story where the adults are calling all the shots. And I think at this point in the story, Jack begins to realize, wow, I actually have some control and some power in this relationship with my dad. It's up to me to take some baby steps forward to meet Norm where he's at. And so it's Jack that suggests the Nuggie Intel. And Norm, of course, is delighted. And they have this really fun outing.
We're talking about middle grade fiction and writing with a keen sense of place in Wisconsin with author Laura Bird. Her new novel is called Marvelous Jackson. Something that is so beautiful, I think, creating almost like the signposts are these aprons. There are these memorable aprons in the book, the ablaze orange one that says, "We love serving hungry hunters." And then there's the red Wauwatosa East apron at Theo's house. And Jack's mom had lacy aprons. Can you talk about what these aprons signify?
I look at those aprons as hugs, like literal embraces from the people in Jack's life, especially the one that belongs to his mother. His mother has passed away, and he puts on that apron of hers. And yes, it's lacy and frilly, and some of his friends kind of tease him because he looks like a little granny. And he doesn't care because it's a hug from his late mother. And so he does wear different aprons throughout the story. And I make a point of mentioning that those aprons are never his. And so there's a moment at the end of the story that comes where he finally gets his own apron. And I think he appreciates it so much.
And I really love how, you know, the aprons really kind of help guide us as a reader through, you know, just Jack's moments and his development. And it's also interesting because you realize just how self-aware he is as a kid with his own emotions, with, you know, counting the days since his mom passed away. Can you speak to that self-awareness about and how we get a sense of it as a reader?
Jack is really self-aware. At least he becomes self-aware throughout the story. And I think that's a really important part of his narrative arc. And let me say, too, I think middle grade fiction, you know, some of it, sure, deals with like unicorns and rainbows. But I think by and large, good quality middle grade fiction really dives into big, messy issues like we're talking about. And it trusts that kids can handle these things because they can, because they do have a really strong awareness of the world around them and of their blossoming relationships and their challenges and their struggles. And I think it does a disservice to them to not incorporate that into the book. And so I hope that readers do see Jack's growth and evolution and growing self-awareness.
And with that growth, he starts to find himself with more and more people all around him who are friends and who are at the library, who are just really rooting for him, you know, in life. And I think you send a strong message that even when you don't realize that there are people all around you who are creating a support system in different aspects of your life.
A sense of community is so important to me. And I can see now that both of my books end with moments where the main character is surrounded by all of these people that love them. That's really important to me. One of my favorite writers says, "There's no such thing as other people's children." And I take that really to heart. And all the adults, at least in my books, you know, they're not driving the plot. They're definitely around the periphery, but they are all like really fleshed out, vibrant characters who are serving as this protective band around my characters, especially Jack. And I'm so glad you got that feeling at the end of the story, because I did want him to be surrounded by loving people, because it's our job to not let kids fall between the cracks.
Let's talk about some of the things they bake. Why did you decide to work with actual bakeries around the state to develop recipes and to bring some of these creations to life?
So in the back of the book, there are three recipes that are included. Two of them are for cookies and one is for muffins. And I love supporting Wisconsin businesses, and I love promoting shopping local. And we have so many great bakeries around the state. And so I chose three bakeries. I chose McCready Artisan Bread Company in Egg Harbor. I chose Tilly's in Rhinelander and Bloom Bake Shop in Madison. And I reached out to each one of them, and I said, hey, I've got a question. Would you develop a recipe, a custom-made recipe, for my book that's coming out based on something real that Jack makes in the story? And so I gave them each a list of everything that Jack bakes. And I made up, of course, all these names. Like the Whimsy Diddles, that's a made-up name. I made up the name, but it's sort of a riff on Snickerdoodles, if you will.
Sure.
So each of these bakeries chose a different thing, and they did such a great job coming up with these delicious recipes, which I'm so happy got included in the story.
Real recipes. And
real recipes.
So I can even imagine these young readers taking to the kitchen and really being inspired.
So that's funny you say that, because kids are baking these recipes, whether alone or with their grown-ups, and they're taking photographs and they're tagging me on social media. And so I find these posts of kids, you know, baking the muffins, baking the Whimsy Diddles. And I just want to reach out and hug Jack to me and say, like, we did it. You did it. They're baking your cookies.
Did you realize Jack would be your central character after you wrote your first book?
I did. I realized while I was writing Crossing the Pressure Line, which was my debut, that Jack was going to be the main character of whatever came next. He was a side character in Crossing the Pressure Line, and he was very unlikable. He made a lot of very poor choices. He rode around on his dirt bike all summer and gave Claire, who's the main character, a real headache. And I think in early drafts of Crossing the Pressure Line, I really depicted him in a very one-dimensional sense, kind of as that, like, stereotypical bully. But I realized that was doing a disservice to him, because if you start peeling back the layers on a child like that who's struggling, you know that there are things happening beneath the surface. There's loss, there's grief. And so I started to think about his background and his family and what problems he was trying to overcome. And I knew I wanted to take that and have that be the subject of Marvelous Jackson. So he's been with me for a while. He's been on my mind and in my heart for a long time.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Madison-based author Laura Ann Bird. We talked with her about her new middle grade novel. It's set in northern Wisconsin. It's called Marvelous Jackson. And you can find recipes from the book, including those Whimsy Doodles, over at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today.
Last week on the show, we heard about the return of Gorilla Cookies, a legendary recipe that people thought was gone forever. As we heard, the late creator of the cookie left the recipe to a nature conservancy near Broadhead.
A lot of people were excited about the return of the cookie, and we heard from some of you about it, including this call.
This is Kim from Madison. I'm so excited to hear the Gorilla Cookie is coming back. I've searched and searched for that recipe. I actually know the person who first developed the Gorilla Cookie and his sister, but very difficult to part with the recipe.
And Marcia from Appleton emailed, I am thrilled to hear we will have these cookies available soon. I was at UW-Madison 1961 to 71. I love these cookies. When? Where? It's at the Southern Wisconsin Nature Conservancy, Marcia. And Marcia says, thanks so much for this story.
You can share your thoughts about this or any other story you hear on the show. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.